This podcast may contain content that is not suitable for listeners under the age of 18. If you are 17 or younger and wish to educate yourself about sex and relationships, you should visit scarleteen.com. That's scarleteen with one T.
Hey, I'm Alicia, your non-monogamous relationship coach. Welcome to the podcast where my friends and I chat about our relationships, enthusiastic non-monogamy, polyamory, swinging, kink, and our lives. You'll get a candid peek into what makes it worth it to live life outside the box. And in case you're still wondering, nope, we're not monogamous. Hey, hey, hey. Welcome to the show. Today I have Alex Cox with me. Alex is eccentric. He's been practicing polyamory since 2018, and he helped build an online polyamorous community during COVID while experiencing multiple breakdowns, seeking therapy for PTSD, getting diagnosed with ADHD, navigating multiple partnerships, parenting, juggling major career decisions, writing poetry, and developing a spiritual practice. He lives in Portland and is building community and being his complete self and enjoying life in all its weirdness. And he's sharing his story with us today. You know, in this world that's filled with like love and loss and unexpected challenges, his journey into polyamory took him to places that he wasn't expecting. But as he took a leap of faith, he soon realized that there's so many rewards, as I'm sure you're finding. I hope you enjoy the show as much as I did. And if you do, please leave us a review. And if you leave a review on one of the many podcast listening places like Apple or Spotify or YouTube or any of the places that let you leave a review, I will probably read it on the air. And if I do read it on the air, you might also win something. Go leave me a review, please. Now we're doing it. Cool.
Good deal.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Like I have not been talking to you for 5 minutes.
I know. We're old friends now, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I am excited to chat with you and welcome.
Thanks for the invitation. You know, it's kind of interesting. You've interviewed a few friends of mine and, you know, you recently had the episode with Christina Dynamite, who's a friend and a co-admin on a local group here in Portland. And she was like, she's always looking for men to interview. And it's like, yeah, I can see why that can be a little bit tough. So, you know, I'm willing to do it.
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. Yeah. I really enjoyed that episode with her. It was fun. I love it when us like ADHD people get together and we just start chattering at each other and like interrupting each other. It's my favorite. Not great for podcasting, but it's still my favorite.
The tangents that you can go off on just from that alone. And it's funny because I've had to, because recently many of my dates have been with other neurodivergent people. I recently had a dating experience where like I started dating someone who wasn't neurodivergent, and you know, we get like 3-4 dates in and I'm feeling like the strain in communication. And, you know, we go out on another date and we're sitting there talking and we're trying to figure out how our communication style is. And she's like, you're not asking me any questions. And it's like, I feel like I am, but I'm feeling like I'm having to like pull things out. And I'm like, why am I feeling? Because we're not doing the ping pong. We're not doing the ADHD ping pong of like, oh, there's this in the tangent. Like, so we were missing each other.
That reminds me.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like, oh man, I need to remember that. And it's just my communication style when I'm talking with people who are neurotypical. So, you know, lesson learned.
I love that. I find it really funny when I'm interacting with people that it feels awkward and strained. And I'm like, why aren't we just like sharing stories constantly? Oh, I have to leave space for that.
Yeah. Yeah. That urge, that little ping of the reminder to shut up and leave a gap.
Yeah. Well, since this is nope, we're not monogamous, I was hoping you would share a little bit about your journey through relationships? How did you discover polyamory? Are you polyamorous? How do you identify for a relationship style?
Identification, labeling, doing. These will be common themes because there's a whole thing about labels in our community and labels are important. But then it's also labels, when we take them, they can also come to define what we do. So I've been working on separating what we do versus what we are. And some people practice polyamory as a practice that they do. Some people, it's their identity. For me, it's my identity and what I do. So, like many people, I didn't start out this journey polyamorous. We started out ethically non-monogamous. And to take a step back, I'm married. So my wife and I have been married since 2014. We had a wild weekend where, we had been dating for 3-4 years. We had been engaged for about 6 months. We got a promotion. We were living in North Carolina. We got married on a Saturday and boarded a plane with our two cats and ourselves on a Tuesday and moved to California. So completely across the country from family, all of that good stuff. So and that started our marriage. And, up till then, we had been monogamous, so it had been cool. And of course, you move out to California, you become a hippie liberal and all that good stuff. And but what ended up happening with us was sadly a lot more difficult. In 2015, my wife got sick. She got sick with a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And this is a condition where the myelinated sheath on your nervous system starts getting eaten by your immune system. And from your extremities inward, you get paralyzed. So my wife for about 6 months in 2015, she was paralyzed in a hospital for a couple months in rehab. And then she was in a wheelchair. And then she, through 2015, her healing from that, she went from wheelchair to walker to cane into early 2016.
Wow.
2016, you'd think we'd be calm, we'd be recovering through that whole position. When you're married, you're not sure if your partner is ever going to walk again. You have conversations, and one of the conversations is listen, we haven't, I know you're, my wife had said, I know you're not there. I understand if you, and at the time I was kind of no, I don't want to talk about I can take care of myself, and do what I need to do without seeking anything outside of our marriage, for right now. 2016, it was my turn. So 2016, I had had an arrhythmia for about 20 years, and it worsened as I got older. And in May 2016, I had this big event where, my wife called 911, went to the ER. They gave me the paddles. So I got the nice paddle shock to revert into a normal rhythm. And then at the end of the month, I had a surgery that corrected and found this condition called Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. So for you medical people in the audience, I've already mentioned two really rare conditions that most people don't have. Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is an extra electrical pathway around your heart. So I could have died from that at any point in the first 40 years of my life. People just suddenly die from it. So get on the other side of that. And that's 2015, 2016, and of course, because we're somewhat masochistic, I think both of us, we decided that we wanted to have a kid. So by July 2016, my wife had already gotten medically cleared. I was learning how to live with a regular heart. And we conceived our son, Zephram. And, he was born in April 2017. So 2017, we were going through the new parent stuff and and all of this. And through 2015, 2016, 2017, my wife and I, I always knew from the beginning that we were going to be married. When we met in 2010, that was kind of something I knew that would happen. But our romantic relationship didn't really recover. And you go through a lot as new parents, you go through a lot going through health issues. We had codependency. We had a caretaker relationship. So April 2018, I was pretty feeling it. Our romantic relationship, our sexual relationship hadn't recovered. And, there were some other things just going on with myself of, holy cow, I'm a parent of a 1-year-old. There's all, I have this new lease on life that I haven't had for 20 years where I can like go out and not worry about my heart, you know, going into another rhythm. You know, I started getting out and hiking and feeling better. And with that, it's also like, oh, wow, my libido is like picked up immeasurably. So, you know, to be honest, when I did some research because I remember that conversation my wife and I had had when she was in the hospital. And I was kind of like, maybe she's open to it. So let's have that conversation and let's do some research. And I did that conversation terribly. I took some bad advice from Reddit and I went to her and I was like, hey, I would like to try non-monogamy. I would like to go out, have sex, and, you know, I want us to still be married. And you know, I need this for my happiness. And it was not presented in a very ethical way. My wife was put under pressure to, you know, allow this to happen. And she said, to her grace, she said, yes, provided that we get couples counsel, couples therapy.
Oh.
So, yeah. So it's like, thankfully, somebody at some point had turned me on to polyfriendly.org. And I went on there and we found a really great couples counselor in San Jose in the Alameda, who I credit with saving our marriage, you know, and keeping us married. You know, so we started couples counseling. I started seeing other people, meeting people. And one of the first people I met was my first poly partner who lives here in Portland. So we were in the Bay Area. So that was a really, really good thing. That was a blessing. And this first poly partner, really just kind of, you know, did some unique things. And I want to put a pin in that and give a pause if you have any questions or anything there before we kind of move into that phase. But that's how we got started.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. I love that. Totally relatable. The medical things, my husband and I, when, right before we got married, actually, he had a very similar heart thing. He's had several, cardioversions and, a couple of heart surgeries and we were non-monogamous the whole time. We've been non-monogamous the whole time. We've been together for about 10 years now, but, I understand that caretaker role. Like, how do you maintain romance and like passion when you're also like dealing with doctors and caretaking and like, just like, here, let me help you.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, there is a whole psychology behind it. Thankfully, like there was a woman I knew through a local science fiction community who was a caretaker for her husband. And while my wife was going through all of her illness, you know, she just kept checking in on me and giving me solid advice. And like some of her advice was take care of yourself, go out, spend time, you know, invest a bit in yourself as you're doing this because you're running a marathon. You're not doing a sprint. So, and that turned out to be really good advice. She helped me out a lot. And my wife went through so much. Like I cannot understate how much my wife went through. Like it's incredible her will to learn to walk again and recover from that.
I wish more people would take that bit of advice for all the things in relationships.
Yes.
Like take care of yourself. Go do your own thing. Be your own person and don't be completely intertwined with this person that you're naturally drawn to be really intertwined with.
Exactly. And you know, it's one of those things when we talk about breaking down monogamy, you know, is what level of monogamy is like healthy interdependence and what level is codependence. And then when we get into polyamorous relationships, how do we break down that line between interdependence expectations from monogamy and interdependence in varying levels and types of partnerships in polyamory?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so hard to figure out like what that looks like. Like we don't have a lot of examples of that. So a lot of people are left going like, is it me? Is it you? Is there something wrong here? Am I doing this wrong? Are you doing this wrong? Which one of us is being an asshole?
Oh my gosh. I default to me. At any given time, like if just given my personality, my history and everything, like if there's a question of who's being the asshole here, I start with me and then go from there. And that's just a good general rule. Like you can't control other people, but you can look at yourself and your own actions, and you can try and get different perspectives and listen to other people's perspectives on how they view you. And that can help you like answer that question first before you have other conversations.
Yeah, totally. That's what I tell my clients all the time is start with assuming positive intent. Like if this is someone who loves you, let's assume that they aren't intentionally trying to harm you.
Yeah.
Right. Like they're probably doing their best. So assume that unless there's someone who's intentionally trying to harm you, and then like, let's do something else.
Oh yeah. There's a phrase I've been learning. Okay. So let me pause it. And we probably should have started this at introduction, but I am not a therapist or counseling professional. Please, like, any advice that I have, I am a regular dude who has been living and going through stuff. And, you know, I think we all need professional help. I think developing community relationships with just average people who are going through stuff, I think that's critical too. Because we learn and we get support from the community, our partners, you know, our people. And I think that that's an important thing. And that's one of the reasons why I came on, because it's like, I don't have anything to sell. I don't have anything that I'm like putting up. I'm just, you know, a regular guy out here in the community that, you know, just from circumstances has ended up talking with a lot of people and interacting with a lot of people who are non-monogamous and polyamorous. So that's why I wanted to come on here and speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I think community is such an important piece.
Yeah. Yep. The phrase though that I was starting to mention, and you know, as a therapist, you know, I'm sure it's unconditional positive regard is the term, and it's this concept that you know apparently is taught to some therapists and some counselors of how you can separate the things people do from judgment about who someone is. And when I hear that phrase, and I'm sure many of the listeners, you know, when I said it, are already have locked up on that first word, unconditional, because unconditional is a challenge. And it is not something that I can do. I try to do it with everybody I meet, but unconditional, I have conditions. I have past trauma that I will judge people from. I, you know, there's experience and there's things where I just lock up and I say, I can't deal with that. But generally, I try to have some sort of positive regard for. I try to find something, even if they're being brusque or aggressive, I try to find something likable about that person. Because every person that you meet, everyone has somebody that they love, has people who love them, has friends, like regardless of what they've done, there's something there, or who you think they are, there's something there that you can find to relate to. And that often can make the difference with yourself in how that interaction goes.
Unconditional positive regard. I love that. That's a real thing.
Yeah, that's a... Yeah. Yeah. And when I first read about it, I was like, oh, wow. It was kind of like a coming home. It was like, this is what I've kind of like all the work I've done the last few years on myself. This is kind of part of what it's led to, like getting this concept. So,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But the beginning of that path was meeting my first poly partner.
We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Alicia here. You know, the voice you've been tuning into episode after episode. Today, I'm popping in with an invitation that's really close to my heart. Behind the scenes, I've been crafting something special just for you, my dedicated listeners. If there's a voice inside you that's seeking guidance on navigating the realms of relationships and non-monogamy, wanting to like boost your confidence and find that unwavering sense of security, or you're struggling to manage the tricky waters of jealousy, I'm here to offer my support. I've cleared my schedule to open up 50 slots this month for free one-on-one clarity chats directly with me. So this is your opportunity to dive deep into those pressing questions and come out on the other side with newfound clarity and direction. The availability on this is super limited and these spots are going to fill up really fast. So don't miss your chance to connect with me. Head over to my website, alisiapayne.com, right now. Go secure your spot because together we can uncover a path to a more joyful, fulfilling, and easy non-monogamous journey. Talk to you soon. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I'm curious. So, met her online. And she was a little bit younger, which, you know, there's different thoughts and attitudes about age and things like that. So, you know, generally I try to date within like plus or minus 10 years and things like that. This particular person, she's still in my life now, and it's a pretty interesting story, but she had been polyamorous since she was a teenager. She was well practiced, well versed, very experienced in poly and non-monogamy. She was with her nesting partner, who's now her husband. And, you know, she blessed me with her poly starter pack. So, because everybody has one, it's like, you know, when you start getting into it, what is that collection of books, podcasts, you know, just things to learn about that is the intro starter pack to polyamory? A common one is The Ethical Slut. So yeah. She gave me the Ethical Slut. She also recommended The Jealousy Workbook.
Yep.
You know, and then the other book that she recommended was The Four Agreements.
Yeah.
So The Jealousy Workbook, it was kind of funny because that one I kind of needed the least. In high school, in college, I'm 45 years old. So I'll go ahead and say my age here. But I'm 45. And I grew up in rural Virginia, like a small town of 6,000 people in the mountains of southwestern Virginia. And my first early relationships in high school, I was extremely jealous. I was jealous. I was controlling. I was a conservative. You know, those people do exist. They're a valid thing. And, you know, I was extremely jealous. And that led to a lot of stress. It led to a lot of anger, control, just really toxic stuff that even then I kind of felt like, man, this is bad. And that relationship went on and off for over 5 years. And one of the ways that it kind of started to end, because it wasn't really the end of it, but the beginning of the end, was I'd found out that she cheated for like months, you know, and I found out in a really bad way. Like I kind of walked in on them and it was like a whole thing and it led to this really tense moment. And then afterward, you know, I found out dude had a gun that night. So I could have been shot. Yeah. So it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, is any of this worth getting killed over? And when you look at like the violence, when you look at like all the aggression and stuff like that, that happens, a lot of it's, you know, people, you know, a lot of it is like this scorned lover kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I went off to college. You know, I did 2 years of community college and then I went off to my university and I spent that year. I didn't really date a lot of people. I spent a lot of time just kind of like thinking through this jealousy thing because I knew I didn't want to carry that forward in my life. And so I kind of broke it down early. It's like, what is important for me in a relationship? And keep in mind, this is like I'm 19, 20 in a dorm room in Kentucky, trying to figure this out on my own. And what it came down to is that the choice. I wanted someone who showed the choice to be with me. There's no amount of control that you can exert over another person to be with you. There, you know, I mean, we see it all the time. Like people lowjack their partners on Wi-Fi, you know, or on their phones, or they put cameras up in their homes or things like that. And essentially, you're building prisons for your partners at that point. Like if you can't trust somebody, where is that? So I figured out
I had
in an
that
early
experience. My first marriage ended because there were cameras in my home.
Oh my gosh. Woo. That is terrible. And that, and sadly, terrifying. That's a too common story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I got into a relationship in my early 20s where I had met a girl and, you know, she told me that she was dating somebody else. I was like, cool. And I met another girl. And I told the first girl, like, hey, I'm dating this other person. And this is, you know, probably 2001, 2002. And just like the communication around that felt natural. Like, yeah. And we went several months, like both dating these other people, both seeing each other. There was a lot of emotion and love there. And we're still friends like 20 years after. But I look at that. I look back at that relationship from unpacking jealousy then and developing that communication style just between me and this other person. That was my first ethically non-monogamous relationship.
Yeah.
Just kind of stumbled into it.
That's so cool.
Yeah. My relationships after that didn't follow in that pattern. And I always look back at that relationship as one that was really healthy. We were very communicative. We were very like engaging. We still have a lot of positive affection for each other. And, you know, if we didn't live across the country, who knows, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so fast forward back to now, you know, the jealousy workbook, honestly, that's something that I felt I had a handle on pretty early on. And through my partnerships, that generally is held true. That choice, allowing the people you're with the freedom to choose. And when they, you know, do that, you know, it's a natural, you end up in a natural, almost secure relationship just enough from that.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You know, when we, you know, later on, we'll talk about the book Polysecure and attachment theory and all that, but you know, but so the jealousy workbook was one resource. The ethical slut, I think that's been talked about here before. Like so many people can say so many things about that. I read that and I was like, yes, this is the sex I want to have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Right. And then I held off on the four agreements because, you know, I had been what I considered spiritually inert for like 10 years. Uh-huh. You know, so I had had like the shock paddle treatment, you know, and the heart condition and all this, and having a child, like my son looks like me, like he's almost, except for like his eye size and shape, he is my little clone. And, you know, I remember in the hospital having this experience of like seeing every family member that I've ever loved on his face. Mm. So that was the closest I had to a spiritual moment. So I had a flight over to North Carolina for work or something like that. And I read the four agreements on a flight. It was like a 5.5 hour flight, read the whole book. Then the stuff about shamanism and shamanic practicing, I was kind of like, yeah, all right, I'll take that. But let's get down to what these really are. You know, be impeccable with your word, make no assumptions, be excellent at everything you do, you know, and all that. And it made sense. It was kind of like some rules clicked into place of like, oh, wow, there's something here for me to use.
Yeah.
So, and the stuff about shamanic journeying and practicing, you know, I kind of took in anyway, because I'd been meditating since second grade. I'd been in martial arts in college, in high school, college, you know, all that. And meditation was part of that. And getting into the journey state and grounding was similar to the exercises I used to do to keep my heart in check.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, all right, let's try some meditation. Let's do some visualization. Let's start picturing some stuff. And it ended up being a really transformational tool for me to start identifying with past trauma. So what happened because of meeting that first poly partner, because of having that book, I had been in this state where for some years of my life, I felt emotionally numb. And I had this very common thing where, you know, I, as a man, as a cis male, masculine, one of the most acceptable feelings that any of us are socialized to be able to feel is anger. Yep. Like, you know, given most men, and I include myself in this, you know, pre-2019 or so, if you give a man a choice between feeling sadness, despair, depression, you know, any number of things, we develop our own internalized shortcut to anger, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the acceptable social response.
Yeah.
You must be angry. You must defend, protect, you know, all these sure. things. And it's exacerbated because, you know, I'm an ex-cop. So I was a police officer from 2001 to 2006. So I grew up a little bit with violence. I grew up, you know, with firearms. I carried a gun for 5 years of my life, and I have exerted violence on other people. And that's I think that, you know, in right now we have so many people who are veterans. We have so many men who have come back from combat and war. You know, we have so many people who are in law enforcement, security, and we just have a lot of people who by socialization, by culture, by choice of their own, you know, live in this state of protectiveness, maybe fear, a little bit of fear involved and, mm-hmm. and anger and violence that, we get comfortable in that shortcut to anger and we don't let ourselves feel that full emotional spectrum.
Yeah. So much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. So what ended up happening, you know, after reading the Four Agreements, starting to do meditation and all this, is that box of anger that I had stemmed from I had locked down and kind of started to contain it when I was 15. Mm-hmm. There was an incident that happened when I was 15. It was the last time I had ever lost control of my anger. And I identified that that moment, that piece, is when I boxed everything up and I started bottling things up. And everything after that point in my life just was this like numb progression of varying stages of anger. So I started to work with that, started to unpack it. I started to let myself feel different things. Yeah. What's it like to really be happy? What's it like to be sad? What's it like to feel all these things? And there's a wonderful tool. It's like an emotional wheel that has like these like big, broad feelings in the center.
Like anger,
it has all these
sadness.
Yeah. Yeah. And it has all these little nuances on the outside. Somebody has hit me that wheel. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I can use this. Am I feeling angry or am I feeling morose or am I feeling,
uh-huh. You know,
Yeah.
It's so good.
And it's almost like, yeah. And when you start letting yourself feel that, like it goes into other things, you know, because then you can start like reading a book. What did I think about this book? I loved it. I liked it. I hated it. I, you know, it made me cry. It, you know, did all these other things. When you start looking at art, it's like, oh, wow, this is a thing of beauty. This is beautiful. This makes me joyful. This, you know, and we have different expressions. We have wonderful tools at ourselves, laughing and crying. Mm-hmm. And laughing and crying, I mention these things because laughter can be representative of the whole emotional spectrum at any extreme. Crying can be representative of that whole spectrum. You know, maybe not even at any extreme. I'm a crier. I will cry if I feel like emotional about something. I will cry if I'm angry at something. I will cry if I'm, you know. So 2019 was this like thing of going back and using some of the tools from the Four Agreements and the subsequent books to go back and like unpack all that. And that is kind of what I consider the period where I really started unpacking masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that led through that. And that was my first poly partner experience.
Wow. It's amazing to me how people influence, like how each of our relationships influence who we are. It's one of my favorite things about non-monogamy. You know, when you're in a kind of a default monogamous relationship that's supposed to last forever, it's like you're also supposed to stay as this one person that doesn't ever change for the rest of your life. But like every time you interact with new people and have new relationships, you get to become something new, even if it's just with that person or you know, it changes a little bit with each interaction that you have. Yeah.
You know, this goes back to that doing versus being. Right. Oh, because we, you know, as we in childhood, we start learning and we get asked, what job do you want to do? And it's like, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And so we get this concept
of a mermaid.
Yeah. What label do I want to apply to myself as I get older that helps define who I become? You know, I wanted to be a police officer. I was fortunate enough to become a police officer and live that dream and do that. And then I also left being a police officer. So when I left, I had to go through this whole thing of like, what's my life like now that I'm not? And it's a very freeing thing when you remove a label, because when you remove a label, you have the opportunity to transform. You have the opportunity to change and acknowledge that growth. And when I look at my whole life and all that, I've changed drastically. I'm, you know, I grew up conservative Christian. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church from the time I was 11. You know, all these different things. And these were labels that over time, as I let go I was able to change and transform into something else. And that was influenced by the people around me, the culture I was in, the internet. Oh my gosh. Like for our generation, the internet was like, when that turned on, it was like the world suddenly at our fingertips.
Yeah.
Yeah. So separating that being from doing, allows us to do more and by what we do become different. Not always necessarily more, but different.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so, okay. So you were a Southern conservative cop, monogamous, who now runs polyamory communities and is very non-monogamous. I am really, really curious about, you had mentioned unpacking masculinity, and now I'm really, really curious about that piece of that.
Yeah. Let me just first say, like, running polyamory communities, I'll say I admin, I've started during the pandemic, I started a Discord for a large Facebook group in the Bay Area, Bay Area Polyamory.
Yeah.
Excuse
during
me.
COVID.
During COVID. So we're talking April 2020. I'm sitting at home one night. We're using like Facebook Messenger as a chat. Facebook group at the time, I think, had like 1,100 people in it, something like that, in the Bay Area. And we were all, you know, in Facebook Messenger in one chat, and like we were losing, you know, track and stuff like that. I had just left my job at Apple, where I was for 13 years. And I was about to get a job at Meta, Facebook. It was Facebook at the time. And so I was in between, and one night I'm sitting there and I'm like, I could start a Discord. It's like, all right, well, you know, so I popped in chat and I offered to start it and help out. And I kind of put together a proposal for the owner of the group. And she said, yeah, run with it. So I started up the Discord, and, you know, I had never viewed myself in any kind of like community admin position or anything like that. What ended up happening over the next few months, like, it was a journey, because like we all started working from home. We were all at our desks, like Discord was up. And we ended up getting, like, when we topped out, I think we topped out at like 150 people in the Discord, and I was holding like weekly, happy hours on Fridays, and, you know, just meeting a ton of different people that, unfortunately, sadly, I don't think I've been able to meet many of them in real life even afterward, but like, just, I got to see this really human experience across a broad number of polyamorous people, through 2020. And we went through so much together. Like there were periods where like there were two times that I just broke down and I cried under my desk. I'm an extrovert. So like leaving the office was tough for me. It was just like, oh my gosh, like I don't have anywhere to go. I don't have people. That Discord community became my community. It became like the growth. I don't see myself as leading it. I see myself as maybe facilitating and helping and being a resource. And even now, like I'm very cautious of coming across as any kind of authority, coming across as any kind of owner, or coming across as any kind of leader. You know, sometimes that may happen, but I am very flawed myself. You know, and that's one thing that like, again, I just want to express, like, there is being and there's doing, and sometimes in life, like we are all messy humans, and, you know, we talk about good people, bad people, we talk about, you know, we put labels on people. It's just, you know, and it's like some of the worst people, you know, sometimes end up doing something good. Some of the best people do bad things, and we are forever inundated in media of people that we put on pedestals that fall.
Yeah.
And it's like unpacking masculinity, you know, around this time, 2019, 2018, 2019, like I'm going through this holy cow emotional explosion of stuff. We also had the Me Too movement, you know? So it's kind of like the Me Too movement came, and all of a sudden every rational man that I've ever known is suddenly like going through the backlog of every interaction that we've ever had in our lives of, where have I been shitty and misogynist? You know, where have I been toxic? You know, where have I, you know, treated somebody bad? When have I used a pejorative? When have I sexually harassed someone? When have I abused someone? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like we all had these moments of just being real with ourselves of, you know, some of it is a little bit self-defensive of who's going to come out of my woodwork. Sure. Who's going to, what skeleton is in my past closet? Some of it is, am I a shitty person? Right. And it's kind of like there's some reflection there that I think many of us had. And for me, thankfully, I didn't see too many bad things out there. I was raised by a single mom. So like one of the elements of my life has been, you know, seeing women in positions of power and authority and being comfortable with that. Seeing women as autonomous people who can make their own independent decisions. You know, my mom didn't get married until I was like in my 20s. So like I always saw her as a single parent. Yeah. So you get through these things and, you know, we go through the Me Too movement. We I'm starting to unpack, you know, feel emotions and figure this out. And you look at where in your life are you being shitty? Where in your life are you treating women differently and or maybe using people, things like that? And so, you know, I think being conscious in polyamory, where it is inherently sexual, it is inherently about relationships that transcend gender, that have traditional dynamics of, you know, there are some elements of patriarchy that exists. There's elements of toxicity, of unpacked toxicity that right. come in, and there's elements of abuse that come in. I've always been careful about any kind of leadership position because one, I am cognizant that I am prone to mistakes. I am cognizant that I am fallible, and I will talk with you about my flaws and I will own up to them. You know, and I have some that I've made since. I don't want to say that like I became polyamorous in 2018, unpacked masculinity in 2019, checkbox done. I've been good ever since. That hasn't happened.
I'm golden. Follow me.
Exactly. Exactly. And I would be cautious about anybody who does say that. Right.
Yeah.
So what I say is I am a member of the community, just like anyone else, trying to figure things out just like anybody else. Don't necessarily follow me, but let's have a conversation and let's see how we can learn from each other. Because I'm still learning too.
Yeah. Yeah. Always. It's like there's no end to what you can learn. There's no end to like even, you know, a lot of my work is working with people around jealousy because I grew up and until I was like 35 was just like, I'm a really jealous and possessive person. Like that was just it. That's just who I thought I was. And then I was like, I'm going to be non-monogamous. I got to figure out how to work with that now.
Yeah.
But it's like, even doing all of that work, it's like, it's still, there's always things that come up and there's always things that like, oh, that's still there a little bit. Oh, there's a new thing that I didn't know would like create these feelings. Now I got to learn a whole other thing.
It is a process. It is a whole process. And you know, you said something interesting there about possessiveness because very much, you know, as Americans, we are rooted in ownership. We are rooted in, you know, we're going to have our house. We're going to have our car. We're going to have all these things that we own and our
partners. And it's mine. Go get your own.
Yeah. Our partners, our spouses, they become part of that like halo of things that we own around us.
And our kids. So,
and our kids. Oh, God, my gosh.
It's wild.
Yeah. My child has let me know. He's six now. He lets me know continually that I do not own him. So it's a continuing discussion. So, yeah. So 2019, I had a breakthrough. You know, I went off into the desert and spent a weekend just unpacking that incident when I was 15. And I came back. And around the same time, I was telling my family that that, you know, my wife and I were open and polyamorous. And, you know, literally the trip, I'm coming back from Sequoia National Forest. I'd been camping on my own and my family decides to have a Skype call, you know, so My mom had already been out. We had talked about polyamory and all this. She had let it leak out to the rest of the family. So I get on the Skype call as I'm driving through the Central Valley, and my uncle gets on, and one of my uncles gets on, and he's like, "I want to talk to you about this." It's like, "I'm happy to talk to you about this. How about we do it when, you know, we're on a regular call and I'm not like driving and we don't have like signal loss and stuff like that." That call ended up being fairly traumatic. My uncle ended up doing this chant of shame. Another uncle joined in, and it was just this experience of like, holy cow. Like, I just came back from this like transformative experience where like I've unpacked anger and all this other stuff. And here my uncles are literally doing like the Game of Thrones scene, you know, throwing shame, yeah, saying, chanting shame, 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 shame. And it was just, I was amazed. I was shocked. I grew up with a really supportive family, and that's the first time in my life that I've ever like had to kind of reevaluate. So I got back to San Jose and I just sent them a message and I was like, "Hey, right now we can't talk. You know, these are the conditions that we got to put around like future communication. But right now this is kind of like it. This is the way I'm going to live my life. And we can talk about that. I can share more with you about that, but you know, this shame stuff, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen around my son. It's not going to happen around my spouse. Like, no." Took a couple years, but I'm talking to them now, and we're kind of going through that. So it's been interesting. So, you know, as you come out, as you become public about things like this, as you break away from those labels, the people around you will respond and change. And one of the interesting things is like going through like the four agreements and some of that other stuff around self, around development of self, is you have to renegotiate and sometimes break those expectations of others of you, expectations of yourself of you, expectations of society and culture on you. Because our society and culture places a lot of things on us as men to act in a certain way, behave in a certain way, do certain things. And those are the things that we have to challenge in order to have that personal self-growth, whatever that's going to look like for each person.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. So one of the biggest fears a lot of the people I talk to have is that like coming out to like family finding out or community finding out that they're not in the monogamous relationship that everyone thought they were. And like, oh my God, then what's going to happen? How did that feel?
You know, it was interesting because like, I was changing physically, because of my heart condition. I had been through weight challenges my entire life. I grew up, you know, chubby. I, you know, like even when I was in college and then at the police academy and I was running 5 miles a day, I think the smallest I ever got was like 195 pounds. In the police academy, I was like 220. After law enforcement, I hit my heaviest of like 367 in 2010. By the time I moved to California, I was at throwing out a whole bunch of numbers, but you know, I was around 300 range. And from 2018 to like 2020, I got down to 235. So at this point, I'm losing a lot of weight. A lot of stuff's happening. So I was physically changing because, and it's interesting, you know, like before I went through this change, the clothes I wore, I didn't wear colors. I got into that, like, I'm going to wear black. Mm-hmm. I'm going to wear black polos, and I'm going to wear jeans, and I'm going to wear the khakis and Dockers, and I'm going to like get on this management fast track and just do the thing. And as you know, I started feeling more myself. I wanted to express myself differently. You know, I didn't have facial hair most of my life. Of course, now you can tell I have a big beard. I didn't grow out my hair like most of my life, you know, and there's some race stuff in there because I'm part black. You know, but so I had this experience of like holding my son and watching my son grow up. And the first like little curl he had come up, I was like, I cannot let him feel shame about his hair. I'm going to grow my hair out. So at work, I was growing my hair out. I was changing my appearance, you know, losing weight. I was wearing colors. you know, for the first time in ever. And so there was visible things. And then when I decided to come out as polyamorous and start telling people about it, it was because thinking through that piece of how do I want to represent myself? How do I want to show up to other people? Mm. So it never became, once I figured out that I want to live openly and I want to show up as myself, as my complete self, wherever I am, then that became the thing of, I will pay any price for that.
Yeah.
You know, at that point I was really successful in my career. I was a manager of a team. I was responsible for a lot. And, you know, I came out, my boss was from Texas. You know, he seemed okay, but like he and I, we really didn't, you know, do too well after that. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't say that it was about that. Could have been about other changes. It could have been that just my general personality was different. And that kind of makes some people uncomfortable, because that's the other thing. Like when you start breaking molds, when you start like challenging, you know, when you start living differently, you know, and I say this as a human, but also like, especially as a man, when you can start having real conversations with men about other men, about emotions and feelings and expressing yourself differently, there's a level of discomfort that people who are locked into that mindset will naturally carry.
Yeah. You're doing that thing I'm not allowed to do.
Yeah. You're breaking rules. What are you doing, man? Yeah. And so telling people about this is what I do, that became a natural thing. And by being willing to pay the price, like there was a conversation I was having with another tech company at one point to like be a director or something like that. As soon as I mentioned that to a buddy of mine, like who was, you know, handling some of the negotiations with the execs, radio silence. Mm. And I determined then it was kind of like a director role would have been like a big jump. It would have been like, wow, that, you know, I've made it, you know, whatever. But I determined then if I was in a role, if I was in going to make a move for my career, where I couldn't show up as my whole self to work, I couldn't show up as my complete self, I don't need that career. Like I can find other things to get into. So, you know, I was pretty thankful for that. It ended up being a blessing. You know, and that was part of the drive to like leave the company I'd been at for like 12, 13 years and go somewhere else. And, you know, eventually getting into the pandemic, like again, removing labels gives you freedom to transform.
Yeah. Which is scary when you don't know what that's going to look like, but I don't think it's very often that has a bad result.
Yeah. If I had been purely motivated by money, you know, definitely different moves. Mm-hmm. But I was more motivated by living authentically to me. Mm-hmm. And it still turned out well. I still, you know, have done well, thankfully.
Yeah. Love that.
So because I don't want this to be all like stars and wonderful stuff, 2018, I want to mention, I met my second poly partner, made a whole ton of mistakes. Wonderful classics like, hey, let's bring them on our family vacation with their kid a little bit early. So did that one.
Let's do everything together. It'll
be
great.
Yeah. Let's do some toxic stuff. You know, so that was a challenging time. That one lasted the last half of 2018. And then that ended. 2019, I met my third poly partner, fell in love, you know, did travel, did all kinds of different things. And that was challenging. 2019, there was a lot of family counseling, you know, and that was when the end of 2019 was when my wife and I, my wife told me that she did not want to have a romantic relationship with me. Mm. So it fit for what our relationship was. Thankfully, with the counselor, with the marriage counselor, we worked out what we'd been breaking down codependency, but we started to work out like, well, where do we meet? Where do we overlap? My wife and I live well together. We enjoy living together, even without a romantic relationship. We enjoy raising our child together. There's some things about our life where like we just, you know, those things work well for us. We're both neurodivergent. You know, we both, have mental health issues that we got to deal and take care of. So we decided to become nesting partners and co-parents. Yeah. And that's what we are. We're non-romantic nesting partners and co-parents. And we've been doing that since winter 2019. And we're still ticking along. And we're pretty happy this way.
I love that. I love that. I wish more people saw that that was an option.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's like, the thing.
Like you can have community. You can have your family.
Yeah. As we break down, again, breaking down our traditional concepts, you know, of what does marriage mean? And what is a marriage agreement? And what does that mean? Yeah. And it's like at different times we'll check in, you know, and we'll talk about like, well, what would it look like if we were to divorce right now? You know, what would our assets look like? How would we make this split if we were to do it? That's always an option. Yeah. And that's something I say to my wife. It's like, anytime you want out, pull the eject button, we're out, you know, and we'll figure that out. We'll work it out and we'll do what you need to do. And
the
same goes for me.
The choice that you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. It all roots from the choice. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it's like, I feel secure in my relationship with my wife because she has the choice to leave at any time.
Yeah.
She, you know, and I look at one of the things that's happening this week. I think somewhere in maybe in Texas, there's legislation that they're looking at divorce now and making divorce more difficult again to remove fault from divorce. Exactly. It's another thing. So it's kind of like, you know, institutionalizing against free will and choice is ludicrous. It's an absolutely terrible concept for managing a society. So, and that's, by the way, is my first bid for, you know, someday running for office. You know, I know on here, if anything I say may be used against me in the future, and that is the first one. So.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious. I'm curious about this when, and I feel like this is a thing that, so there's something that happens, right? You're in a romantic relationship and you're living together and there's things that you're like, I can tolerate that because I'm in love. And this is just, there's, you know, I've got these blinders on, right? And then as the relationship goes on and you kind of start getting annoyed by things and those blinders aren't there anymore, you're like, oh, okay, now we have to like compromise and coordinate and try and make living together work because like living with people is still living with people. But what I've noticed is a lot of times people will like if it's not a romantic relationship, then why am I putting up with these living issues or why am I putting up with these things that I otherwise wouldn't, right? And for some reason it's like, if it's romantic, then it's okay. Then it's worth tolerating life things, roommate issues, right? But if it's not romantic, then why would you put up with roommate issues kind of thing? I'm curious how you navigate that. How does that
land? Your tolerance level goes down, right?
Yeah. Right.
Like the way that they may cough or sneeze suddenly becomes like, grinds on your nerves with every single one. And my wife is going to hear this and she's going to be like, shut up about my sneezing. But I love you. but no, and there's things I do. Absolutely things I do that I know grind her nerves. And when I say that we live well together, you know, what I mean is like we've lived together now for almost a decade. I think we moved in together in 2011, 2012. So like we've lived together for a decade and we live well together. And, you know, after you get past NRE, you know, by the time you go through like the caretaker relationship and stuff like that, it's kind of like, all right, you know, it's we see each other's flaws. We share some of the same flaws. You know, neither one of us are great housekeepers. So that's one aspect of it. You know, so that by living well together, I mean that we make good roommates regardless. And so that goes into that choice to continue living together because let's take your theoretical conversation, you know, your thing here. of in monogamy land, you get involved in a relationship, you get on the relationship escalator, you move in together, you start living together, you love each other madly. The sex is great. Everything's positive, but you cannot, you get through NRE, but you can't stand what it's like living with this person. Like they do things, they put their, they put the toilet paper roll on backward. They, you know, fold their towels the wrong way. Yeah. Yeah. Monogamy land. It's fuck this relationship. We're going to break up and we can't take it anymore. And we get away. Polyamory land. We can say, maybe this person isn't the best nesting partner. Maybe we look at renegotiating or changing this relationship, and maybe we do something else. And the other thing in non-monogamy and polyamory land that we can do is when we meet people and get in relationships and fall in love, you know, we can say, I don't have to escalate this to living together. Like we can be in love, like solo polyamory people shout out like, you know, you can be in love. You can have these deeply intertwined, strong, powerful relationships and not live together. And yeah. And that can make just as much sense. Like one of the beautiful things. So end of 2019, beginning of 2020, I do this shamanic journey thing and I'm like, okay, I need a framework here because this, I'm not indigenous. Like I read the four agreements. Okay. I felt kind of weird about the whole thing. What kind of spiritual framework allows me to go through and, you know, move forward, keep on doing this, work on some more of my past trauma? You know, how can I figure out a way forward from this? I end up on, I found, I knew one guy 20 years ago who was learning and practicing Druidry. And that guy seemed pretty cool. He seemed pretty chill. And I was kind of like, all right, well, let's take a look at this. So I went to a Druid ritual that was local. I started looking at orders, talking to people. I was like, all right, Druidry is going to be my framework. One of the concepts of Druidry, the whole key thing is in what we call, revival Druidry, or, you know, is we focus on fostering love, wisdom, and creativity. I'm like, hey, cool. Here's a religious framework where I can foster love, wisdom, and creativity. The whole first year of that, what we call the Bardic grade, you know, is studying creativity. And I say a year, it took me like 2 years to go through. Yeah. So 2020 to 2021, early 2022, I'm in the Bardic grade. I'm studying creativity and emotion and flow. And, you know, I'm writing poetry and story. And I'm thinking about how I can be creative across all things. And in polyamory, we apply creativity by the relationships that we develop. Mm. You know, because every relationship is an opportunity to create, what represents that bond between any two people.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, which is such a wise choice.
Yeah. But it's not really apparent, right?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, you can go through all these things, but if you're still locked in to what our culture is, if you're still locked into like concepts of masculinity and what we're supposed to be as men, you know, then you never give yourself the opportunity to explore and question these other things.
Yeah.
So removing labels, focus on doing instead of being, giving yourself the freedom to explore and try new things and be creative with it and say, this, it's not the way it's supposed to be because there's no way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, just do it. Just do what feels right for you. And that goes back into self-care. That goes back into developing yourself as a person. So I had met this third poly partner in 2019, early 2019. Deep love. She challenged me. She exposed me to a whole lot of mindfulness things like that. We had an incredible love story. I'm not going to repeat here because one of the things that happened with that is last year, through our own development, we decided to move separate ways. She moved to another city. I moved to the city. I took 2022 off from work. I was blessed enough to be able to take 2022 off from work. So I took a career break. I left Facebook Meta and I said, listen, I'm going to take a year. I'm just going to like live off investments, you know, spend time with my son. He starts kindergarten, get us moved up to Portland where we want to live and stuff like that. Toward the end of last year, well, middle to end of last year, you know, this partner and I had had problems. We had had some relationship issues and things like that. And it culminated when we were on a trip and we got into an argument out on the street. It was late at night and I said something incredibly shitty. Said something so shitty, I can't give the context for it here, but I said something incredibly shitty that no, to my core, no version of me in their right mind would say it, but I said it. And I take ownership and accountability for saying it. And then I ended the relationship. And I ended that relationship very poorly, very badly. And it's something I've apologized for privately, publicly. Like there's a number of different things about the way that I ended it. But I also look back at my journals because I write. And what also became clear when we talk about constructing relationships, what really became clear to me, like as I was breaking down that breakup, is it's also important for us to identify when do we end relationships and how do we end them well?
Yeah.
Because that can also be creativity as well. De-escalation of a relationship, transformation of a relationship, reconstructing agreements, things like that. So, you know, somewhere leading up to that, I had read the polyamory breakup book. That's another good book on breaking up. I did not apply any of the lessons from that book, just to say it. And this is where I get into we're human. You know, you know, I've done shitty things. I will continue to do shitty things. And I will continue to make mistakes. And the way I broke up and ended that relationship was a really bad way to do it. But that would not recommend for anyone. For all the work that I've done, you know, on unpacking masculinity, for everything that I've learned, for everything that I've tried and done, that one was one that I did very badly. And I think with that, when we talk about creativity, when we talk about breaking up, when we break up with people, they don't just fall off the earth.
Right.
You know, no matter how bad the breakup goes, no matter how, you know, they still have friends, you have intertwined lives, you have friends together, you have things that you've done. You know, generally when people break up, you know, they don't fall off the end of the earth. So when we talk about polyamory community, you know, especially in a town like Portland or Seattle, over time, everybody knows each other. Everybody, you know, knows somebody else who's poly or has dated somebody else, or, hey, I swiped right on that person, or, hey, you know, we went out on a couple dates, figured out it wasn't the thing, that's it. So one thing I think about in terms of polyamory, in terms of creativity, and in terms of, you know, our lives and wisdom is, and I say this to other people, we are poly, and throughout our lives, we hopefully, this is the ideal, right? Hopefully we will fall in love with many people throughout our lives. And we will fill our lives with love, relationships, and connection, and all these different things. So with as much importance as we place and as much attention as we place on building our dating profiles or meeting people or going out on dates, developing communication styles to build a relationship, developing communication styles to maintain a relationship, we also have to work on communication styles in de-escalating and ending a relationship. Because how we go through that whole arc will kind of determine our presence and our health and our relationship with the community throughout the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is a point where a lot of people just kind of, I'm just going to try and shut down, block. I'm going to block the person. I'm going to block the feelings. I'm going to block the consequences.
Yeah.
Let me block all this. I don't want to deal with that.
And I think that's part of the thing from monogamy culture too, because like, you know, when you're monogamous, ideally that next person that you meet, the next date you're going to have, that's going to be the one. You're going to ride the escalator, get married, ride off into the sunset happily ever after, and you won't have to do it again. So in a nutshell, those relationships, you know, become, when they end, that person becomes disposable. You know, that person becomes somebody that, you know, screw them, not going to see them anymore, I'm going to move away, or whatever trauma happened in the relationship for both of you. You know, you end up both trying to separate and block, and there's a lot of tension around that. Polyamorous relationships, especially when you're dating other people in the community and stuff like that, and if it's a small town, they don't just vanish. And over time, you build, there's a collection of people that you've had past involvements with that like are there. So I think one thing when we talk about community and we talk about like what we're doing is how do we long term begin have relationships and end them well, acknowledging that we're all just like messy humans trying to figure things out.
Just trucking along.
Yeah.
Okay. We're coming to the end of our time, and I want to ask if there's anything that you want to share that I haven't asked you.
Yeah. So to kind of cap off the story, move to Portland, get up here. And, I found another admin for the Bay Area Poly Discord. And, by that point I'd also become a Facebook admin, and I was, helping out among all the other admins on the group. I get up here and I start looking at Facebook groups in the Pacific Northwest for polyamory. Yeah. And I start looking for community. I also looked on FetLife because I'm in kink and all that. And I went to my first coffee meetup I went to was pretty flat. Nobody asked my name. Nobody showed any interest. It was definitely kink focused, and it was like interesting. Second poly meetup I went to just happened to be with a wonderful group. And here I want to give a shout out to Delphine Lumen, who was a guest on a previous show, who ran that particular coffee meetup. And I met people who I'm friends with and who I've dated and who I'm partnered with and, who I still know that essentially formed the core of my poly community here. Over time, there was another person who, gave me a shout out one day and was like, "Hey, how would you like to help me out with the poly chat?" So I was like, "All right, let's do this experiment. Let's, do this. If I were to start a poly chat from the ground up, how would I want to do this?" And it's kind of like, when I think of community, what do I want to do? So I started up this chat with this guy, and I told him, I'm like, "I don't want to own this. Like do everything in your name. I will be an admin. I will help out, but I don't want to own. I don't want to do anything that calls me a leader." But when we started putting people in, I was like, "Let's be bold. Let's do something different." I put in my wife, invited my wife. I put in people I had dated and stopped dating. I put in current partners. I put in like just everybody I knew in the poly community into this one single chat. And when you start talking about like putting your exes in a chat, it's like, wow, this is bold. And that was probably 3 months ago, and that's worked out. We have a thriving little private community of about 50 people who interact. Nice. We're starting to have events. We're starting to do stuff. And there's a lot of big Facebook groups of like 1200, 1500 people. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of admins of those groups in the chat just because we met them. But really we've just formed a little, a community of around 50, 60 people that may fluctuate, grow, things like that, that all kind of know each other, all practice polyamory kind of a similar way. We've already gone through the unicorn hunting thing and all that. And we just really strive for ethical, healthy community. Some of us have kids, some of us like to craft, stuff like that. And I think when we talk about polyamory community and building polyamory community, there's a saying from Druidry, think globally and act locally. And if you are living somewhere where, you don't have access to a lot of poly community, or you don't feel there's a lot of poly people around, and you're in a position where you can be bold and open, I encourage you to try it. Do it. Be open. Pull people together who might not otherwise talk because of the way things are supposed to be. Granted, there are gotchas you got to watch out for. You've got to watch out for things about abuse. You have to watch out for things about anything around in consent violations. And there are some very toxic gotchas. But what I strive for is I strive to help people feel a culture of openness and acceptance. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to that unconditional positive regard with limits.
Yeah.
Oh, so I love that. I think that's the NCAT. You know, I'm settled here in Portland. My career's restarted. I'm back doing something professionally that has nothing to do with this. And like I said, I'm not selling anything. I am a practicing druid. I practice druidry, again, labels, but, and I've also formed co-found a druid seed group that, again, I don't own. It's nice to be able to move somewhere new and within a year, find community, make friends, develop partnerships. And, you know, it's just being open, being authentic with yourself and with others and, you know, doing the work. Yeah. So I encourage anybody to do the work. If there's any men out there who have been challenged, who kind of want to talk more on this stuff, like I think I gave you my Instagram link, I'm open to messages, email, whatever.
What's your Instagram handle?
Yeah, it's really original. It's Alex_Cox.
Nice. With an X.
Yeah.
So, and I'll put it in the show notes.
X's.
Yeah, two X's. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, see, I've been writing it wrong.
Alex is one X, and then Cox is a second X.
Oh, yeah.
If there was another X in there, that would just be too much. That would be triple X. And while I do that, that hasn't been the content of our discussion today.
Alex X Cox.
Yeah, just Alex_Cox.
I say, what is your porn name? Middle initial
Alex
X.
Cox. Yeah, that was the joke. Like, middle school, a whole bunch of the kids, used to say Alex Cox. And, one of the things in unpacking things is I found out, hey, I'm hetero flexible. I can, I have a little bit of flexibility there. So the joke's on them. I have suck cock. It's been an interesting thing, too.
I love it.
I'm hetero romantic, but I consider myself a little bit flexible in that area.
I love that. That's so hot.
Yeah.
I have one more question for you.
Sure.
And this one does not go on the episode that everyone is listening to, but is a separate segment for my supporters of the show on Patreon, patreon.com/notmonogamous. If anyone wants to go over there and hear Alex's Just the Tip, which is
just the tip.
What is your favorite or best sex tip? I love it. That's so good. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been fun. It's been one of those things where it's like, well, this came up real quick. And it's like, if I think about it too long, I'm not going to do it. So let's do this.
Yeah.
And get into it.
Yeah. So good. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This was fun. That was Alex Cox's Just the Tip. If you are one of our supporters of the show at patreon.com/notmonogamous, then you got to hear it. If you're not, go sign up so you can hear Just the Tip and all of the behind the scenes bonus stuff that I load onto Patreon. Bye. Thank you so much for listening today. It would mean the world to me personally and would help us keep this little podcast going if you would subscribe, leave a review, or share this episode with your friends. For more personalized support with your own relationships, we can work together on a one-to-one basis. Just visit my website at aliciapayne.com and schedule a free call to chat about life, the universe, and your relationships. Bye.